Good morning and welcome to Shattering Myths, a program devoted to what may be among the largest segments of our society. To those of you like me who've come to know that there's something troubling, even destructive, about the religious and political institutions, the media reporting and military interventionism, as well as jaundiced economic schemes that are all being credited for being the solution when we know, in fact, they are the problem. And realizing that they are the problem, not the solution, it is incumbent upon us to look behind the headlines. And so our mission is to understand who is causing these tragedies that are besieging our planet, all while predicting how the events that they are inspiring will influence our world. And that is why during our second hour, we're going to provide hope. We're going to engage God on His terms through evidence and reason, since His guidance regarding His covenant provides hope, the only reliable source of hope in an exceedingly troubled world. Anytime over the next 2 hours, if you would like to participate in this discussion, you're invited to do so. Our toll-free number is 877-300-7645. It was another bad weekend for Islam. Islamist gunmen in Nigeria went on a rampage against schools. They killed 50 students. The students were shot dead as they slept in their dormitory, mostly at the College of Agriculture in the Yobe State. Now imagine a religion so perverted, imams, religious clerics so twisted, that they would encourage young men and women to brandish weapons, to go into a college dormitory where the students are studying not to wage war. These students are studying to grow crops, to feed people. And that while they were sleeping, not while you were engaged in some kind of self-defense or battle, you'd murder them. And that you would believe, you would be so indoctrinated by your politicized religion that you would believe that you were doing a service for your God. You were, in fact, in shouting, encouraged to shout, Allahu Akbar, as you perpetrated this heinous crime. I've said many times in this program, and I'll say it again. If you do not despise Islam, if you are not part of the solution whereby you are exposing and condemning Islam, then you're less than human. Then you're no better than the savages who kill in this manner. This notion that you're being tolerant and therefore enlightened and merciful when you embrace and accept and tolerate and run interference for politicized religious teaching that is this corrupt, this brutal, makes you no better than they. In fact, in many ways worse, because in the West, you have the opportunity to read about these tragedies, to think about them, to study the words and deeds of Muhammad, to see how these acts are manifest in the Islamic scriptures. You have that opportunity. And yet you squander it. Truly, if you do not despise Islam, if you have not reached a point where you say, you know, there is a common denominator behind all of the atrocities, all of the suicide bombings, all of the mass murders, all of the poverty, all of the deplorable treatment of women, all of the rage around the world, and that common denominator is Islam. If you haven't reached that point, then there's something wholly deficient in your ability to process information rationally. After the Muslims murdered these 50 agricultural students while they slept, they set fire to their school and to the dorms, and those who were still alive were burnt to death. Casualty figures, of course, vary, but the best estimates that more than 50 young men and women were killed. Reuters is reporting over the weekend that at least 40 people were murdered when a suicide bomber blew himself up in a Shiite Muslim funeral. The blast brought down the ceiling of the mosque in the south of the capital of Baghdad. Police said that many bodies were still trapped beneath the debris. There were at least twice as many gravely wounded as were killed. Those inside had been mourning the death of a man killed earlier, a day earlier, by Islamic jihadists. It's lovely, this religion. I'm going to go kill an innocent person so that when other innocent people mourn the death of that person in their mosque, I will then send in a suicide bomber to kill the mourners. It is a lovely religion. Until now, we are trying to retrieve bodies from the debris. Most of the bodies are torn to pieces. Legs and hands were scattered all over the walls and ceiling. It was not immediately clear who was behind the bombing, which is the latest in a spate of attacks targeting both Sunni and Shiite places of worship, particularly during funerals. Yes, this has become a signature act for Muslims in Iraq, the country that America invaded, broke, and then left in the grip of a civil war, that a disproportionate amount of the attacks target mosques and funerals. And yet Muslims will scream that the reason they're justified in killing infidels in the West is because they target Islam. They are the enemy of Islam, they will say, and that they kill Muslim women and children. And yet, 100 times more ruthless are the Muslims themselves, targeting their own religion and killing their own women and children. This article says that the delicate sectarian balance, that's a term that we find parroted in so many of these articles, a delicate sectarian balance. When you see lines that stupid repeated in most articles, you can attribute it to collusion. There is nothing delicate about the rift between Sunni and Shia Islam. Never been delicate. It has always been bloody. That's why Yahweh spoke of Ishmael's descendants and said that in addition to being wild asses of men, their hands will be raised against their brother's hand raised against them as they live in hostility with the whole world. They have been at each other's throats, killing one another for 1,300 years. This continues to say, coming under the strain of the civil war in neighboring Syria. No, that is backwards, and we've talked about that as well. But when you see the truth inverted and repeated, again, you have collusion. The Syrian civil war was created because of the United States invading Iraq. The sectarian strife in Iraq emerged as a result of the U.S. invasion. And because of that invasion, Syria came under the control of Iran, as did Iraq. That is what caused the war, because the Saudi Arabians and the Qataris did not like the fact that Shia Islam was now more dominant in terms of power and positioning than it had ever been. And so they launched a proxy war against Shia Islam in Syria. One thing followed the other, not the other way around. And yet this article and so many others will tell you that the sectarian violence in Iraq is because of the civil war in Syria, when the opposite is true. Perhaps they don't like the idea that America started the civil war in Syria and that America started the sectarian violence that we're witnessing in Iraq. Now, by starting it, yes, the sectarian violence, the fight between Shia and Sunni Islam over who gets to control Islamic rage, who gets to focus Islamic rage, has been 1,300 years under the military dictatorships of Assad and Saddam Hussein. The bloodshed associated with that blood feud had been kept to a minimal amount. But after the American invasion, it erupted, blossomed out of control. Both Sunnis and Shias, they say, have crossed the border from Iraq to fight on opposite sides of the conflict. That also is not true. Sunnis have, but not Shias. Al-Qaeda's Iraqi and Syrian branches. Al-Qaeda really does not have an Iraqi branch. It's the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. They were never allied with Al-Qaeda. But it is true that Al-Nusra Front, the leading jihadist rebellion group in Syria, claims to have a great affinity for Al-Qaeda, particularly Zawahiri. This article, and amongst the most stupid things that I have read in a very long time, said that suicide bombings are the hallmark of Al-Qaeda. Gee, and you know, suicide bombings began in Islam way back during the time of the rise of the Ottoman Empire. That's when young Muslims were brought into to the estate called the Old Man of the Mountain. It's one of the crossovers between Islam and Roman Catholicism, with the Knights Templar studying the jihadi tactics of the Old Man of the Mountain, who was Islamic cleric. He would bring young boys into his estate, where he would lavish them with prostitutes and with marijuana. In fact, the hashish and marijuana is the term that gave rise to assassin. It was derived from a corruption of the word hashish because they were drugged to become assassins, and they were told that if they died, in other words, became a suicide bomber in the process, that they would go directly to Allah's brothel. We'll return after a moment. Yes, this journalist has the gumption to say that suicide bombings are the hallmark of Al-Qaeda. You know, suicide bombings became the rage when the PLO decided that they could inflict murderous carnage on Jews. And the PLO was born in the 1960s, grew to be the world's leading terrorist force in the 1970s and through the 1980s. The political party is called Fatah, still exists, the PLO still exists, but it was the world's most prolific and most barbaric Islamic terrorist group, funded by Muslims from around the world, particularly by the Saudi Arabians and the Egyptians. Its carnage on Jews was horrific, and the most common tactic throughout the late 1960s, 1970s, and 1980s was suicide bombings. For 20 years, before Al-Qaeda even existed, before the United States decided to use the Taliban and the database of one Osama bin Laden to launch a proxy war against the Russians in Afghanistan, 20 years before they existed, dear journalist, suicide bombings were the hallmark of the PLO. And so if they're the hallmark of the PLO, and if they are used around the world by some 100 different Islamic terrorist organizations, when does it become obvious that suicide bombings are the hallmark of Islam? And why must you lie? Dear journalist, have you no journalistic integrity at all? Has your politically correct education and your Machiavellian approach convinced you that truth no longer matters? That a lie is effective so long as the lie is somehow conducive with your cause? Or have you just lost the ability to think? That was over the weekend. This is now today. A series of car bomb blasts, mostly suicide bombings, in the Iraqi capital of Baghdad have killed at least 47 people and injured many more. The most recent article I've read says that 54 people were killed. The blast targeted markets and car parks, mainly in the Shia Muslim districts of the city. There has been a recent upsurge in sectarian violence. Why don't they just say of Muslims killing Muslims, sparking fears of a return to the bloodletting of 2008? Do you know that the carnage that we're witnessing now in Iraq is almost identical to 2008? And you realize that 2008 is a direct result of the United States invasion of Iraq? That prior to the U.S. invasion of Iraq, there were no suicide bombings in Iraq, none. And the number of terrorist attacks each year was always less than a handful, typically between one and two. And the number of people killed in a terrorist attack was typically in the range of three or four a year. And now 20, 30, 40, 50 people are dying a day. And then on the average day, there's a score of Islamic terrorist attacks. So this idea that it's not that bad because it's not as bad as 2008 is sort of like saying that the Holocaust wasn't so bad in 1944 because it was much worse in 1943. There have been, it says, more than 5,000 people killed so far this year. Actually, there have been more than 6,000 people killed in Iraq. And every one of those people, although they were killed by Islamic clerics urging those boys and girls who attend their mosques to be enraged and to hate and to have no reason to live, only a reason to die, and that that this is the expression of Islam, it's what Muhammad taught. The fact is that it was being kept under control before the American invasion. Monday's blast struck during Baghdad's morning rush hour, with reports of 13 different bombs, most of them, but not all of them, in Shia neighborhoods. Groups of common laborers, average workers, guys just trying to survive, were the targets of most of the bombings. Stunning what man will do to man in the name of religion. Welcome back to Shattering This. Continuing with the carnage of Islam, 17 people were killed over the weekend in a bus bombing in Pakistan. As we look around the Islamic world, it doesn't make any difference which country they're in. Muslims have an affinity for brutally savaging Muslims. And in the Sudan, which is the most ruthless of all Islamic countries, and the Sudanese government, which is fundamentalist Islamic in the Sudan over the past 25 years, has murdered 3 million African animists, African Christians, and African Muslims. They decided over the weekend when some people were protesting, and this time it was in the north where the protests were occurring, leaving their Friday prayers, they shouted, "Freedom, freedom!" Yes, right. It's this idea that if we shout freedom as if we're Democrats, then we'll get support from the West. We want the fall of the regime, they shouted. The fact is that that regime has survived a genocidal attack, killing 3 million people, and yet the world has done nothing. It's astonishing how the world chooses who it wishes to thwart in their genocidal rage and who the world wishes to support. We have Jason, a good friend of the program, calling in from Toronto this morning regarding Saudi Arabia. Hello, Jason. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Yeah, I just had a question. I wanted to get your insight, your opinion on some things. I watched a news report from one of the more, you know, conservative news organizations in Canada. They spoke about how there was like a commercial, a campaign advertising the oil sands here in Canada.
Yes.
And they were comparing it to Saudi Arabian oil and calling it ethical oil and whatnot. And their story was about Saudi Arabia or the Saudi Arabian interests, you know, hiring a big law firm to, you know, bully the broadcasting networks to take it off the air.
Yes.
When really they had no case and whatnot. And, you know, that right. actually is quite disturbing. I mean, how deep does it go? You know, like, as far as Saudi Arabia, like, you know, dictating what's on our TV and...
Very is the answer. Yeah, very is the answer. The Canadians are correct. The oil sands, which could supply the United States' thirst for oil and therefore eliminate the need for America to buy OPEC oil, which would... cease the engine of Islamic terrorism. It would run to a halt because without the revenues from OPEC, Islamic terrorism would not be capable of exporting itself out of the world of Islam. And so it is a life and death situation. So if your oil capability is being presented as ethical by that standard, it is. Now, I've looked at all the aerial views too of the environmental damage that is done by this form of oil extraction, and when you look how vast the land is and how constrained the extraction points are and how they're then reclaimed as forested land after the extraction, you know, it really a good argument can't be made that it's a damaging to the environment. We should not do that for that reason. And of course, this administration has been opposed to the Keystone Pipeline, which would take those oils down to be refined in Texas, where we have excess capacity. Now, your question was really on the Saudi Arabians and how they, and it's more than just the Saudi Arabians, it's also the Qataris and the Kuwaitis, and how they get their will in the United States. You've got several different things working simultaneously. One of those is that the Saudi Arabians make huge investments in American universities to educate the future journalists. So they devote that money to make certain that those who are going to choose English and journalistic careers are indoctrinated into their propaganda. So they're already jaundiced coming out of school. The second thing that they do is they have very large investments in America's media, whether it be in primarily electronic media. Television is the largest of their investments, along with news services. And so their ownership of those things has put them in a very dominant position where if you are willing to speak out against Islam, your career is over. Then the next thing they do is they make very large investments with political candidates, and many through the pretense of business. For example, George W. Bush's pretend business in the oil exploration, where, you know, he never actually did anything but made enough of a fortune to buy a significant share of the Texas Rangers. Abrusco Oil. Well, Abrusco Oil had a singular benefactor, was the Bin Laden family. If you look at the investments of George Bush Sr., King George the First, his principal income came from the Carlyle Group, where he managed the investments of the Sauds in military investments that were organized by the Carlyle Group. And so the American politicians are in the pocket of these guys. The moment that a president ceases to be president, he goes over and does an honorarium speech for the Dassans, and they'll pay him $2 or $3 million. And so, if you want to know how deep the problem is, it is so deep that the media is influenced, the legal system is influenced, the politicians are influenced, the journalists are influenced as they graduate in these politically correct schools that take gargantuan amounts of money from the SODs to infiltrate our education system. So,
Not only that, but I suspect, because we had a lot of resistance with our own pipeline, just to run from Alberta to Nova Scotia,
right,
or to the East Coast,
right,
and they were, some of them were like these environmental groups that,
right,
you know, the corporations were funding, and you got to wonder, like, why wouldn't they use environmentalism to ensure their market? You know?
Yeah, that it's, you can't come up with a religion more Machiavellian than which is the thought behind Machiavelli was the ends always justify the means, and keep in mind that Machiavelli was more religious than he was political, but played in both arenas, and he was an advocate for abusing the power of the popehood in the Roman Catholic Church and how it could be used for political purposes. And his whole thought was, if you want people to obey you, then you need them to fear you. And the ends always justify the means. Islam is perfectly suited for Machiavellian thought. So, yes, there would be no reason for the Sauds not to to also bribe environmentalists to work on their behalf. But what the Sauds want is America dependent on Saudi Arabian oil. And, you know, that's the bottom line in all of this is their wealth. And their wealth is the primary supplier of mosques around the world, and almost all Islamic terrorists have been indoctrinated in mosques somehow funded by the Saudi Arabians.
From another perspective, you think it's possible that the Saudi oil could be the wine of her fornication?
You know, there is a lot of commentary, end times commentary about the influence of Saudi Arabia, the influence of oil, the influence of the merchants of Babel, and the wine of fornication is an example of that. It's all symbolic of the influence of Babylon. And Babylon means corruption. It means, and there's nothing more corrupt than Islam. It means, Yahweh explains Babylon as the overriding presence of religion and politics, militarism and economic schemes within a country that mislead the masses, causing the vast preponderance of people to be unaware of what the Torah teaches.
Fornication would be the religion and the politics.
The means to intoxicate. And also, you know, Yahweh has very little to say about fornication in the sense of illicit sexual behavior. Paul is prolific in his condemnation of sexual behavior, but mostly because Paul was a Gnostic. Yahweh is—he has very little to say. He does say a little bit about adultery, but it's mostly because of it shows a willingness to cheat on one's core, which is marriage and family. And so when we use the term fornication as it relates to Yah's perspective, what he's really talking about is having illicit affairs with false gods, the religious gods, or political gods. And so the wine of that fornication would be, is the elixir is power and money. That is the elixir of religious and political corruption.
Is there anything a consumer can do when they buy gas at the station to, you know, maybe, you know, is there any way
to avoid? Yeah, it's really kind of, we're kind of in an interesting mix. One of these days we're going to do a program on global cooling, because we're in the midst of global cooling, which would say you'd want to do a lot of, in fact, when we do the program, we'll talk about what can we do to resolve the problem of global cooling that is sweeping our planet right now. As a consumer, what we're talking about is really impossible to have any influence over, because this is global politics at its worst. There is no way that I am aware of that you can be assured that you're only buying gasoline that is domestically produced. But the problem with that is that even if you only buy domestically produced gasoline, they're still supplementing it with foreign oil for somebody else. So the supply doesn't care, the oil doesn't care what country it came from.
Do you think Barack Obama, you know, like, people wonder how he got such an expensive education. Do you think he was supported by Saudi Arabia?
No, you know, the ability to provide scholarships at places like Harvard is very substantially influenced by Saudi Arabian investments in those universities. But I think it might be unwise to assume that he specifically was the beneficiary of Saudi money. Certainly he was indirectly. We'll return to Shattering Myths in a moment. Stay with us, Jason. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. Jason has called in from Toronto wanting to know the influence of the Saud government in America and in Canada, particularly academically. During the break, I had the opportunity to Google Harvard and Saudi Arabia. The two things that became the most prominent were the Saudi Arabia alumni of Harvard University. It's an organization that is directed to fund scholarships for students that Saudi Arabia favors at Harvard. It is designed to increase the number of Saudi Arabian royal family members that attend Harvard and to promote the Saudi Arabian agenda at Harvard. One of the next article that I found is Prince Alawid bin Ta'al bin Abdulaziz Al-Saud. Al-Saud means that he's a member of the warlord family that is in control of Saudi Arabia. He donated $20 million to create the Prince Alawid bin Ta'al Islamic Studies program at Harvard. And that was what I was referring to previously, is that members of the Saud royal family invest enormous amounts of money. In this particular case, it was $20 million at Harvard and $20 million at six other major universities to establish Islamic studies programs that present Islam as a good and noble religion. His donation, one of six multi-million dollar contributions to fund academic centers at universities around the world, has endowed professorships and push the program to the forefront of the university's effort to improve teaching and learning to promote international engagement regarding Islam at Harvard. And so it is those kinds of programs that have tremendous influence. This particular fellow, from the Saud family, has two dominant articles in Harvard's magazine. One is on Islamophobia, where he is would have you believe that anyone who exposes and condemns Islam is afraid of Islam, when the opposite is true. You have to have no fear of Islam to be willing to do what I do on this program, because you receive so many death threats as a result of doing so. And he then funded an IMAX presentation on the Hajj, showing how wonderful that pagan rite is to Muslims. So, Jason, yeah, it runs deep. The illicit gains that were possible because the Saud family in Saudi Arabia nationalized, confiscated British and American refineries, and then created OPEC, and the world did nothing to stop them. And since that time, if you actually trace the creation and the rise of OPEC, and you layer side by side, juxtapose the rise of Islamic terrorism, they're coterminous. Islamic terrorism was something that was only perpetrated Muslim to Muslim within the Islamic countries prior to the rise of OPEC, and once OPEC rose, particularly funded through Saudi Arabia, you find a rise in this, fundamentalist Islamic mosques around the world and the exporting of terrorism. They are coterminous. So, Jason, does that answer your question, or are you still concerned that perhaps the this intersection between Saudi Arabia and governments and academic institutions and media institutions is not as tight as some would suspect?
Yeah, I guess it was what I suspected, but I just wanted to hear what you thought about it, because I know you're well educated in the subject. So,
yeah, when I did my research for the Islamic Terrorist Highline, Jason, that's what I found, is that there, if you wanted to find the one common denominator that parallels the growth of Islamic terrorism, because Islamic terrorism was almost non-existent in the world beginning in the 1950s. It began in the 1960s with this enormous wealth event that was accumulated by the OPEC Islamic nations, and how that wealth was used, you can show a direct correlation between that and the rise of Islamic terrorism as the dominant brutal force, really, that is attacking our world.
And this will just become more and more influential if the mind doesn't stop.
Well, the money won't
stop.
The money won't stop, and they have become more influential. For example, look at Qatar. Qatar is the was the source of the weapons that that placed the fundamentalist government over Libya. Qatar is the source of the weapons that are arming the Syrian Sunnis to kill so many people in Syria. Flow of money is increasing, and the United States has become a co-conspirator, because the United States is the major supplier of arms to these countries, and they just distribute them to the most fundamentalist Muslims.